Good day, and welcome to the Constitutionality of Voting Rights Amendment Act 2014 press call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Jesse Grauman. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you all for joining us for today's press call on the Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014, hosted by the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy. My name is Jesse Grauman. I am a Director of Policy Development and Programming at ACS. As many of you know, the Supreme Court's decision last summer in Shelby County versus Holder invalidated a key portion of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Specifically, Section 5 of the Act required certain states and localities with a history of discrimination in voting to pre-clear any changes to their voting laws by having them reviewed either by the Department of Justice or a federal court in Washington, D.C. In Shelby County, the court found that the so-called coverage formula that Congress used to determine which jurisdictions were subject to that pre-clearance process was unconstitutional because it was based on older data instead of what the court called current conditions. The court did explicitly state, though, that Congress could craft a new coverage formula based on current conditions. On January 16, 2014, Representatives James Sensenbrenner and John Conyers, along with Senator Patrick Leahy, introduced the Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014, or the VRAA. The VRAA responds to the court's invitation to craft a new coverage formula, but that's not all it does. It also includes a number of other steps designed to update and improve the Voting Rights Act in a manner responsive to the Shelby County decision. Today, ACS is pleased to be releasing a new issue brief titled The Voting Rights Amendment Act of 2014, A Constitutional Response to Shelby County. It can be downloaded at our website, www.acslaw.org, at the Publications tab. And we have on the line with us the five co-authors of the brief, five leading scholars. We have William Yeomans, Fellow in Law and Government at the American University Washington College of Law, Nicholas Stephanopoulos, Assistant Professor at the University of Chicago Law School, Sam Bagansas, the Professor of Law at the University of Michigan Law School, Gabriel Chin, Professor of Law at the UC Davis School of Law, and Gilda Daniels, Associate Professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Given time constraints, I'm not going to recite any additional biographical details beyond noting that of these scholars, three of them, Sam Bagansas, William Yeomans, and Gilda Daniels, have all held senior positions in the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, which enforces the Voting Rights Act. We'll begin with very brief presentations by the scholars and then open things up to Q&A. So I'll start off by turning to Professor Stephanopoulos. Your portion of the brief discusses the new coverage formula in the VRAA. So can you tell us just a little bit about what the proposed coverage formula contains in contrast to the previous one that was invalidated in Shelby County?
Sure, Jesse. Thanks for the question, and thanks to everyone else for joining the call. So the old formula that was struck down in Shelby County covered jurisdictions that had turnout of less than 50% in either 1964, 1968, or 1972, and that also used some kind of test or device in those years to restrict access to the polls. And the court, of course, thought that this formula was obsolete, that it was based on data that was too old to be rational in 2013. So the new formula, instead, uses what's known as a rolling trigger for coverage. It looks only at the last 15 years to determine which jurisdictions are covered, and it asks whether there have been five voting rights violations over that period in states, including at least one violation committed by the state itself, or for other jurisdictions, whether there have been at least three violations over that 15-year period. And violations for these purposes mean either court findings of liability under the Constitution or under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, or denials of preclearance under Section 5. So that's how the new formula would work. It's based on this rolling time period rather than old data from elections from the 60s and 70s.
And what is your view, your conclusions on the constitutionality of the new formula?
Sure. That's a very good question. Let me make it. I think it's clearly constitutional. Let me say three things on that issue. The first is that the court's main criticism of the old formula was that it was obsolete. It was based on quote decades old data and eradicated practices. The new formula completely avoids that critique of the old formula. So the rolling trigger is based on data that by design is never more than 15 years old. This is precisely the, quote, current data that the court was talking about in Shelby County. That's the essence of the new formula. And I would note, too, that the 15-year reach of the new formula is less than what the reach of the old formula was when it was upheld by the court in 1980 and then again in 1999. Second point here is that, you know, the formula isn't only based on recent data. It's also a very reasonable way to distinguish between jurisdictions that should be covered and ones that shouldn't. So a couple quick factual tidbits here. There were only about five Section 2 findings of liability per year over the last couple decades, and there were only about 25 Section 5 preclearance denials per year over that period. So if a given state has five voting rights violations in a 15-year period, that means that the state is really a problem jurisdiction. It really is worse with respect to racial discrimination in voting than other places in the country. And so it warrants being targeted by the formula. And a final point here is that in Shelby County, the court over and over again used the language of rationality. You know, the court thought the old formula was irrational, it was obsolete, unreasonable. Never once did the court use any more stringent language, such as congruence and proportionality. So the takeaway, I think, is that the new formula only has to be rational or reasonable in order to survive constitutional review. That's a relatively low bar, and I think it's very difficult to argue that an updated formula based on current data about voting rights violations isn't at least a rational response to the problem of racial discrimination in voting. So for all of those reasons, I think the new formula is quite clearly constitutional.
Okay, thank you. Let's turn now to Professor Chin. Your piece of the brief discusses the expansion of the availability of the bail-in remedy. Could you just take a moment to explain what bail-in is and what the VRAA would do with regard to bail-in?
Sure. Thanks, Jesse. Section 3, which creates the bail-in remedy, it's been on the books since 1965. It's part of the original Voting Rights Act. And what it does is it allows courts to require preclearance in jurisdictions which are not covered by Section 4 as a remedy after finding a constitutional violation. So if a court is hearing a voting rights case, it can decide as part of that to bail them in under Section 3. The U.S. Department of Justice is now seeking to bail in North Carolina and Texas under Section 3. The Supreme Court has never suggested that Section 3 might be unconstitutional, and the Voting Rights Amendments Act would expand the availability of Section 3 in one important way. Now Section 3 is available as a remedy for constitutional voting rights violations, for violations of the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment. The Voting Rights Amendments Act would make Section 3 relief available for violations of statutes affecting voting rights. In particular, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act would now be a basis for Section 3 relief, and Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act prohibits state laws that have the effect of denying the right to vote on the basis of race.
And I think you started, you spoke a little bit about constitutionality, but can you just speak a little more about specifically the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Amendment Act's expansion of bail-in?
Sure. I think Section 3 in general is likely to be looked at much more favorably by the court than what was at issue in Shelby County. First, what triggers the relief is more specifically tailored to the particular facts and circumstances. A court evaluates bail-in on a case-by-case basis based on a finding of a violation in that case. So it's not imposing preclearance based on a general formula that put a lot of weight on what happened decades ago. In addition, the remedy under Section 3 is more tailored and more limited. First, it's time limited. The bail-in under Section 3, the preclearance under Section 3 doesn't go on forever, only for so long as the court deems it necessary. It also can be limited to particular types of electoral changes, so the jurisdiction wouldn't necessarily have to preclear every single electoral change. Instead, the court could determine that particular types of electoral changes were particularly important or particularly susceptible to discriminatory application, and so a court might say that only redistricting has to be pre-cleared, or only changes to voter qualifications.
Great. Okay, so now let's move over to Professor Bagenses. You wrote about the preliminary injunction provision. So can you talk about what the preliminary injunction provision of the VRAA does, and why is this important in the post-Shelby County era?
Sure. So one of the very important aspects of preclearance has been its ability to stop discriminatory voting changes before they go into effect, because once a new voting practice goes into effect, even if it's unconstitutional, and even if a court later in the day discovers that it is unconstitutional, it can be very difficult and disruptive to unwind its effects. So one of the aspects of the pre-Shelby County world of preclearance that was very important was having this ability to stop discriminatory practices before they start, while courts or the Justice Department at that point had an opportunity to look at whether they were discriminatory. What the preliminary injunction provision of the Voting Rights Amendment Act does is it says when somebody is filing a lawsuit to challenge a voting practice under the Voting Rights Act or the 14th or 15th Amendment or another voting rights law, there will be an easier standard to meet for obtaining preliminary relief to essentially stop that voting practice from going into effect while the court decides whether the law, whether the voting practice violates the 14th and 15th Amendment or the Voting Rights Act. It says the only thing the courts are supposed to consider in voting rights cases now would be, at the preliminary injunction stage, would be whether the hardship to the defendant outweighs the hardship to the plaintiff of granting an injunction. And so the court should not try to decide the merits of the case before granting a preliminary injunction. Instead, it should just freeze matters in place if the balance of hardships tips toward the challenger while it considers whether the new law is constitutional.
And can you comment on the constitutionality of this specific provision?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, in some ways, one of the most straightforward provisions to justify constitutionally for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, it is widely acknowledged that Congress has quite broad power to adjust the equitable powers of the federal courts to decide the circumstances in which they shall grant injunctions, particularly preliminary relief. So that it's just saying what happens while the case is pending. This provision wouldn't ultimately say what happens at the end of the case. That's something that Congress has acknowledged to have very broad power with respect to. The concern of the court in Shelby County that different states were being treated differently obviously doesn't apply here, because this provision of the Voting Rights Amendment Act would apply uniformly across the country to every voting rights case. To the extent that there are concerns raised in other contexts by the Supreme Court about the constitutionality of federal civil rights laws, those concerns tend to be about statutes that try to change the substantive rules that apply to states, that say you can't engage in this practice, you can't engage in disability discrimination, you can't engage in some practice that itself is not prohibited by the Constitution. But the preliminary injunction provision of the Voting Rights Amendment Act does nothing with regard to the substance of the underlying rules. All it does is adjust the procedure to be followed in cases brought under the Voting Rights Act. So all it does is say, while one of those cases is pending, before the court has the opportunity finally to decide whether a voting practice is lawful, the court should in many cases, stop that practice from going into effect to give space to make a decision that then can go into effect without too much disruption. That's sort of at the core of Congress's powers and so ought not to be something that is unconstitutional.
Thank you. Now, Professor Daniels, you've written, I know, previously on the subject of notice and transparency in the voting context. Why is notice of voting changes important in the post-Shelby era, and what would the VRAA accomplish in this regard?
Thank you, Jesse, and thank you to the American Constitution Society for coordinating this effort on this very important subject. In regards to your question, pre-Shelby, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act required covered jurisdictions to publicize voting changes, and moreover, those changes were stalled or frozen until they were approved by either the Attorney General of the United States or the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Now, without those publication requirements or notice requirements under Section 5, citizens learn about voting changes certainly more through happenstance. And often when it is too late to impact decisions. So without the notice requirements under Section 5, there's essentially little required notice for voting changes. And under the VRAA, that would change. And the Voting Rights Amendment Act would require states and political subdivisions to publicize only certain information pertaining to voting changes. It would require them to publicize changes, any changes to voting practices and procedures that would occur before a federal election. It would also require them to publicize changes to polling place resources, like the number of voting machines and poll workers, and the number of poll workers assigned to each precinct of polling places. Also, it would require the publication of changes to the constituency that participate in the election or to boundaries, for example, if there are voter purges or if there's a change in boundaries in regards to some districts that may have been changed. And those changes have to, you have to notify the public of those changes within 10 days of making those changes.
Thank you. And can you comment on your views on the constitutionality of this, these provisions requiring notice?
Well, I would agree with everyone else, certainly, and certainly as a professor, as the other professors have stated, the constitutionality, particularly of this provision and the rest of the act, is clearly constitutional, and certainly the notice and transparency requirements are constitutional not only under the 14th and 15th Amendments, but as well as the Elections Clause, which requires states to prescribe the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives, but also mandates that Congress can at any time by law make or alter such regulations. And the Supreme Court has been very consistent in finding that Congress is within its Elections Clause authority in addressing issues such as time, place, and manner, as well as notice and registration. We've seen under the Help America Vote Act, as well as the National Voter Registration Act, the use of the Elections Clause and findings of constitutionality under both of those acts, and would certainly argue that the same is true here, and that certainly the notice and transparency requirements under the act are certainly reasonable and certainly constitute a tailored approach that would be consistent with constitutional principles.
Thank you. And finally, Professor Yeomans, in addition to your current scholarly work, and I mentioned you worked at the Department of Justice as well, you also worked on Capitol Hill as chief counsel for the late Senator Edward Kennedy, at the Judiciary Committee, which, of course, would be the committee with jurisdiction over this legislation. So can you just comment a little bit on where the bill stands right now, what the next steps would be.
Sure. Thank you, Jesse, and thanks for reminding me how old I am. The current political situation is fairly straightforward. There are companion bills in the House and the Senate. In the House, Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican of Wisconsin, has taken the lead, as he did in 2006. And there are, at present, 22 co-sponsors in the House, 14 Democrats and 8 Republicans. The bill, of course, has been referred to the House Judiciary Committee. And the next step in the House is for the committee to hold a hearing, and it's up to Chairman Goodlatte to schedule a hearing or a series of hearings on the bill. The hope is, I think, among proponents of the bill that that will happen soon. It has to happen soon if the bill is going to move in a timely fashion and if it's going to be marked up and taken to the floor this summer, which I think is would be the preferred schedule of the proponents. The Senate is waiting to see what the House does. Senator Leahy is the chief sponsor in the Senate, and at this point there are only a couple of co-sponsors, Democratic co-sponsors, simply because everybody is waiting to see what Chairman Goodlatte and the Republican leadership in the House will do. You know, the I think the effort all along has been to make this a bipartisan effort as much as possible, and in recognition that it's easy for voting matters to devolve into to partisan squabbles. But you know, the proponents have tried to keep this on a fairly high plane and press the notion that, that voting rights really should not be a partisan issue, that it's fundamental, they are fundamental to our democracy, and that it's fundamental that people have to have access to the ballot and that to know that their ballots will count. And while certainly integrity of the ballot is important, we can't let rules needlessly impose impediments to voting, and certainly not on the basis of race. So that's sort of the, what the debate is going to be about in the House. And so the next step will be for Chairman Goodlatte to schedule a hearing.
Great. Well, thank you all. Thanks to all of you for those presentations. And now I think we'll open things up to questions, and the moderator will instruct you how to enter, how to ask questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that's star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment. And once again, that is star 1 to ask a question, star 1. And we'll take our first question from Carrie Johnson with NPR.
Hi. Yes, Bill and everyone else, Sam, thanks so much for doing this call. My understanding is that Senator Leahy is still looking for Republican sponsors on the Senate side. I wonder, given the need you've outlined, what your political analysis is for whether this is even doable in such a fractured environment.
Hi, Carrie. It's a difficult question. It's difficult to anticipate that Congress will do most anything at this point. You know, we are in a period of gridlock, and Congress has difficulty rousing itself to take on major legislation. On the other hand, after the decision in Shelby County, there was an immediate response, a bipartisan response, people saying that this had to be fixed. And Eric Cantor has made some fairly sympathetic statements regarding the legislation or the need to address Shelby County. And Jim Sensenbrenner has really become the champion of this. So there is some basis for Republican support in the House. That obviously is the most important piece. And if there is sufficient Republican support and if this can move to the hearing and markup, and if it gets to the floor, it's very likely to pass.
If the House acts, I think it will be a much easier lift to move the bill through the Senate.
And as a reminder, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question, star one. And there are no further questions in the queue at this time.
So this is Jesse. I'm just going to jump back in here, Bill, with a follow-up question for you. There's been some talk, I think, surrounding the bill about provisions that pertain to voter ID, which, as we know, is an issue that occupies a lot and garners a lot of attention in the voting rights arena. Can you talk about what the bill does and does not do with regard to voter identification laws?
Sure, Jesse. The bill has two specific mentions of photo identification, and the first is in the coverage formula, and the bill specifically says that in determining coverage for preclearance, an attorney general objection that was based on a photo identification requirement will not count, so it won't count toward the five state violations or the three violations for a local jurisdiction. And then there's another provision in the portion of the bill that amends Section 3 of the Act, the bail-in provision, which says that a finding of a violation of Section 2 that's based on a photo identification requirement cannot serve as a predicate for imposing preclearance under Section 3. So there are those two specific mentions. I think they will obviously engender a great deal of discussion once the bill starts to move. This is a contentious area. And, you know, as we have seen, photo ID provisions certainly have the potential to disproportionately affect minority populations. The recent decision by the district court in Wisconsin, I think, demonstrated that, as well as the three-judge court in D.C. in the Texas photo identification case. So I think those two provisions will be an obvious focus for discussion.
And let me turn back to Professor Stephanopoulos. I think there are some people who, in the wake of Shelby County, have either argued or who might argue that, you know, the preclearance mechanism itself is unconstitutional, or that this court would find it unconstitutional. And I just wanted to get your take on that argument.
Sure. Thanks, Jesse. So you're right. You know, there are some dicta in the opinion that are quite skeptical of preclearance as a mechanism, you know, at all these days. I guess the argument would be that conditions with respect to racial discrimination in voting are no longer bad enough anywhere in the country to warrant a remedy that's as stringent as preclearance. And I guess the response would be, you know, first of all, the court explicitly invited Congress to draft a new coverage formula based on current data. So there would be no point to that invitation if any formula Congress came up with would be automatically invalid because it tried to use the mechanism of preclearance. So the court's dicta are inconsistent with the court's open invitation to Congress to act here. And then second, you know, if we look at what the conditions are around the country today, you know, clearly they're not as bad as they were 40 years ago, but as Congress documented in elaborate detail in 2006, conditions are still not good in many areas. You know, there's still major issues with both first-generation and second-generation voting rights violations. So these conditions don't seem any different today than they were in 1999 when the court upheld in an earlier case the mechanism of preclearance. So I would think it would be very difficult for the court to make the judgment that conditions simply are not bad enough anymore to warrant preclearance given the contrary congressional findings and given the court's own precedent from 1999. And the final point here, again, I'll just reiterate, you know, the court used this language of rationality over and over again in its decision. So the court would have to say, not only do we think that, you know, preclearance is quite a stringent remedy, but we think that it is irrational for Congress to consider preclearance a necessary remedy today. And that seems like a very difficult thing for the court to do. So I guess for those reasons, you know, there is language that's worrisome in Shelby County, but I don't think that too much weight should be placed on that language at this point.
And Professor Daniels, I wanted to ask you, your portion of the issue brief, you were talking about the need for notice, particularly with regard to, you know, changes that happen at the local level, and your brief does give a number of examples of things that have happened even just since Shelby County, and I was wondering if you maybe could go into maybe one or two of those examples. Professor Daniels, are you still on the line? My apologies. I think we might have lost Professor Daniels. Professor Bagenstaff, are you still here?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Let me just ask you one more question, and then I think we'll wrap up. A little bit about the congressional authority to alter the standards for obtaining a preliminary injunction, and you know, you mentioned that I think that you know, you think it's pretty clearly unconstitutional. Can you maybe give some examples of other, you know,
pretty clearly constitutional.
I'm sorry, did I say unconstitutional? Sorry. Constitutional. Your brief talks, I think, about examples of other laws that are that kind of follow a similar model, and I was wondering if maybe you could give one or two examples of those.
Sure. I mean, so this is something Congress does periodically. I mean, it's unusual, but it's quite far from unprecedented. An example where Congress actually went farther than it would in the preliminary injunction provision of the Voting Rights Amendment Act is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which has a provision that says while there's a dispute over the placement of a child with a disability, you know, whether the child should be in a more or less restricted classroom, during the pendency of that dispute, the child must remain in the classroom that the child started in. So it's called the stay-put provision, which courts have interpreted as creating a mandatory preliminary injunction. So regardless of the merits of the case, regardless of the balance of harms between the parties, until the due process proceedings are done to determine where the kid ultimately should be placed, there's an order that issues that says that the kid has to stay where he or she is. The Voting Rights Amendment Act provision would actually be less stringent than that. It would be a lesser exercise of congressional power than that provision, because it says, although you don't look to the merits of the underlying dispute, you don't try to decide who's going to win the voting rights case before deciding whether to issue a preliminary injunction. A court should look to the hardships of the parties and should decide whether the hardship to the plaintiffs of allowing the challenge procedure to go into effect would outweigh the hardship to the defendants of not having their new procedure go into effect. So it's really the VRAA provision is a more moderate exercise of Congress's power to control the remedies in the federal courts than other statutes, even other civil rights statutes. I mean, there are a number of other examples. Another example I discuss in my section of the brief is there's a statute involving franchise disputes in the petroleum industry where, because of concerns that taking away a franchise essentially would be so harmful to franchisees, Congress said, basically, we're going to have a lesser standard of showing of the merits of the dispute in order to issue a preliminary injunction. We're going to make it easier to issue a preliminary injunction in cases brought by franchisees in that industry. and that's something the Supreme Court has taken note of. So this is, you know, it is not the usual practice, but it's far from uncommon. And in the context of voting, there's a particularly strong reason for it, which is, you know, if you have a law that is put into place that affects who can vote or affects the way they vote, that's found to be unconstitutional after it goes into effect, a court's going to have to decide what to do with the results of the elections that took place while that law was in effect. And you know, so the court has a bunch of really bad options, and courts have recognized this for a long time. A court could decide to rerun the election, but of course, if you rerun the election, it usually won't be at a regular election time. You'll get a different electorate, you'll get much lower turnout probably, and it won't put everybody back where they were in the first place. It'll also be very expensive. Or what a court can do is say, look, we'll remedy it by not having this practice we've now found to be unlawful, be applied at the next election, which means you have the entire period between elections where the fruits of an unlawful election continue to be reaped by whoever won that election. So what the VRAA provision tries to do is avoid that difficult choice, that set of bad options for the court, by saying, look, we're just going to freeze into place the status quo so long as the balance of harms tips toward the challengers of a new voting practice, until the federal court can decide, is this new voting practice something that's lawful or not? And at that point, it can go into effect if the court finds it lawful. It's a relatively straightforward use of a remedial power that Congress has used many times in the past.
Okay, I think maybe we'll just give one last opportunity for if there are any questions from our listeners, and if not, then we'll wrap up in a second.
As a reminder, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question, star one. And there are no questions in the queue at this time.
Okay, well, I just wanted to thank all five of our scholars who joined us, as well as our listeners. Again, you can download the issue brief itself on our website, the www.acslaw.org, and go to the publications section of the website. If members of the media have any inquiries, you can contact Jeremy Lemming, our Vice President of Communications, at jleming@acslaw.org. Thank you very much for joining us, and this concludes the call.
That does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.